let me conclude by addressing one particular fairly fundamental question. Why has it been so difficult to achieve full economic equality for women? And here one can refer to a range of reasons. Lack of equality before the law, of course, has been a key fundamental factor, in a sense. That is what women, business, and the law is all about. If you need your husband's authorization to freely engage in the marketplace, your opportunities as a woman are going to be curtailed. There's a second aspect which I think has to do with lack of education. You know, that wonderful lady, Mary Wollstonecraft, in her 1792 book, Abdication of the Rights of Women, argued that it is not that women are naturally inferior. They appear at times to be so because of lack of education. At least that is the argument that she put forward in 1792. You know, we have a total of 800 million illiterates in the world, of which 530 million are women. In India only, you know, we have some 275 million women who are not able to read and write. So we have a not insignificant share of the world's population who has no access to one of the most essential tools to open the road to prosperity, which is basically access to knowledge and access to information. This is not to say that you know, these people who can't read and write are not able to support themselves or make some kind of contribution to the informal economy, but you can understand how limiting it is, especially in the 21st century, you know, not to be able to have access to knowledge and information. And then, of course, there is the whole issue of the misallocation of resources. Because women are not politically empowered, very often the decisions on spending are largely left to the men who may have other priorities and who tend to sit on the budget committees at the Ministry of Finance and Parliament and so on. You know, there is a very interesting study that was put forward by the IMF in 2012 that looks at the issue of subsidies. You know, according to the IMF, every year we spend something like $1.9 trillion on energy subsidies. These are subsidies for coal, for electricity, for gasoline, and so on. This is equivalent to 2.5% of world gross national product. It is equivalent to 8% of government revenue. Now, what is most interesting about these subsidies is that 61% of the benefits go to the one-fifth richest segment of the population. In other words, they are tremendously regressive in terms of their income distribution effects. Not only that, but they actually make a measurable contribution to global warming. So, you know, it's difficult to come up with a policy that is more socially and environmentally destructive than these energy subsidies. Contrast this with, for instance, education of girls. There is very, very substantial, compelling, credible empirical evidence that suggests that educating girls is a powerful engine of women's advancement. And there is higher probability that the daughters of educated women will themselves be educated. Fertility rates come down. Children are healthier. There is a greater say over household finance because educated women are more likely to be engaged in the workplace and therefore contribute to family income and so on. You know, if you look at the $1.9 trillion figure on an annual basis, it translates into $2,400 available per person per year. For education, you know, for these 800 million people who cannot read and write, $2,400 is a huge sum, and it is available, you know, on an annual basis every year, as long as we have these hundreds of millions of people who are illiterate. In other words, when we say that there are 430 million people in India who cannot read and write, we have to be cautious not to imply that the reason why this happens is because India is a poor country. In fact, no. India spends dozens of billions of dollars in energy subsidies. So in a sense, we're really saying that countries have made a policy choice in terms of how to allocate resources, and as a result of these policy choices, we continue to have, you know, hundreds of millions of people who don't have access to information and to knowledge in the 21st century. Let me conclude sharing with you some a couple of quotes which I thought bring in a very, very nice way, you know, sort of the ethical dimension that underpins a discussion of women's of gender equality. We certainly understand that it has a human rights dimension, and it certainly has an economic efficiency dimension, but there is also an ethical dimension to this whole debate. An American Quaker and an abolitionist and women's rights activist by the name of Lucretia Mott said the following in the year 1849. She said, "Let women then go on, not asking favors, but claiming as a right the removal of all hindrances to her elevation in the scale of being. Let her receive encouragement for the proper cultivation of all her powers, so that she may enter profitably into the active business of life." And then she adds, "Then in the marriage union, the interdependence of the husband and the wife will be equal, their dependence mutual, and their obligations reciprocal." I find this a particularly wonderful thought. And I specifically refer to the phrase in these words where she refers to women's ability to enter profitably into the active business of life. If there is something that women business and the law data shows, is in fact that there are far too many countries and far too many restrictions all over the world which are making it very difficult for women to enter profitably into the active business of life. And the second quote which I wanted to share with you to conclude is comes from a speech given by the head of the Baha'i community in Paris in 1912, when he said, "As long as women are prevented from attaining their highest possibilities, so long will men be unable to achieve the greatness which might be theirs." Thank you.